Hey folks, Rob Wolf here with Greg Everett, and if you can believe it, we have Dr. Kurt Harris here. Doc, how are you doing?
I'm doing just great. How are you guys?
Good, good. Both of you guys discovered that Skype has a text messaging function today, I guess.
Yeah, so if nothing else, Greg taught me how to text message with Skype, so.
Nice.
No more important skill in life.
Transferable job skills. So, I don't know if folks remember, but we dangled a carrot out there in the interwebs back in February to have Dr. Harris on the podcast, and we had 308 responses in that thread, people asking questions, and then Doc was kind enough to come on and answer a lot of those questions at that time. That's one of the biggest threads that we've ever had on here. So obviously you're super popular. And then when I tweeted this morning and said that we were going to be doing the podcast, somebody coined you the honey badger of evolutionary medicine.
Well, that relates to somebody said somewhere, I like him. He just doesn't give a shit. And then at the exact same time, there was this viral video of there's this guy, this flamboyantly gay guy who does these. He'll take these nature videos and he does his own voiceover, not the original voiceover. And he'll do honey badger, a shark, you know, whatever. And they're just you'd have to listen to them, but they're pretty amusing. And he did one on the honey badger, and over he kept just saying, "The honey badger, he just doesn't give a shit," and he would just keep saying it. So
that's the original. I figured that that's what it was, but I wasn't sure if this was some sort of a highway rest stop toe tapping kind of code that was going on my Twitter feed. So, I suspected not. I figured it was because you're a badass blogger, even though we haven't seen you on there in a little while. But
actually supposed to be a self-deprecating thing that I directed at myself. But the shoe fits, whatever.
Nice. Well, you obviously don't give too much of a shit if you agreed to have your name associated with episode number 97 of the Paleo Solution podcast. So we're hugely honored that you're on here. Doc, give the listeners a little bit of an idea about your background as a physician and how you came into this whole evolutionary biology concept and ancestral diet. And then maybe a little bit of an overview, how you first landed at this concept. And then you've obviously grown and evolved your ideas a ton since that inception.
Oh yeah, I've grown my ideas enough that the internet is divided into the people that hate me for what I used to think and the people that hate me for what I think now. So I've got that balance, finally home. But yeah, the way my background is as a radiologist, actually a neuroradiologist, which is the subspecialty of looking at the way Emily Deans actually knows the neurotransmitters in the brain, my specialty was knowing what the structures look like on pictures and, if there's a tumor in something, brain imaging, CT, MRI, a lot of vascular imaging. So I was a radiologist, the medical doctor that sort of looks at, various looks at pictures of various body parts and tries to see if there's disease there on the macroscopic scale. And that's something that, you get your MD and then you do residency training. And I did fellowship training. I actually have an academic background too. I was assistant professor at University of Iowa for 2 years and did a fair amount of research, actually, clinical research. Bench research. I did. I was thesis advisor in Department of Biomedical Engineering at University of Iowa, and worked with on spine biomechanics. So did basic bench research there and participated in some of that stuff. Did clinical research for a couple of years in academics. A lot of times, what happens is you'll have there's a process where you review papers. And most of my experience with that is usually the senior guys will kind of give the junior guys the actual work to do. So, for instance, for the journal Spine, you won't ever find my name, as a reviewer, but I would get handed articles by the guy, the senior guys, and they'd say, "Kurt, write a review, review this for the editor." So I did that for a number of different journals for a couple of years and got, you know, I thought reasonably good at, you know, finding holes in what was wrong with the research. And, of course, spent some time on the other side of that, too, having the stuff that I wrote picked apart and, you know, told why I didn't know what I was talking about. So that's, I could bore you with the details of my whole life, but basically I'm a doctor, I'm a radiologist, and I have a research background that extended from when I was a medical student through when I was assistant professor, which was close to 6 or 7 years. And, you know, I spent a lot of time, you know, reading and writing papers, and that's been a while, but that interest stayed with me the whole time. Then, as I frequently pointed out, I heard of good calories, bad calories. I had no particular health problems that I was, you know, anxious to solve, and I wasn't obese or anything. So, you know, I heard this book being discussed on the radio, and I read it, and then that led me to read other things, and obviously quite obvious to anybody that's paid attention to my comments in the blogosphere. My views have progressed quite a bit since then, you know, and pretty much in a stepwise fashion. It wasn't really all at once, but just kind of an evolution.
And, you know, I just have to throw out there Matt Lalonde, who's about as critical a thinker as I've run across anybody. He really loves a lot of your work, both you and Stefan Guionet. He's felt like a lot of your blog posts with a tiny bit of additional tinkering should have probably been submitted to any one of a number of journals. So you're doing some amazing work when you're pumping that stuff out, which obviously you've got a great background in it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That means a lot to me. And the cool thing is that Matt, I've never spoken with or communicated with him at all, and I stumbled across, I don't know, somewhere I found he quoted me on something a while ago, and then, I didn't know who is this guy. And then I heard him on, I guess I listened to his Jimmy Moore interview, and I just thought, wow, this guy thinks just like me. So there's, you know, finding somebody that comes at it from a completely different angle, a guy who's actually, let's face it, I'm not a biochemist, okay? You know, radiologists aren't biochemists, and increasingly my angle is more reading in paleoanthropology and archaeology, and Matt Lalonde seems to come at it, you know, from the more micro detail, you know, being a real chemist. So when it's cool to me when you hear somebody that has a completely different background and their kind of big picture look at things is very similar. So, yeah, it's mutual, I think, a lot. And I haven't listened, you know, it would take a long time, obviously, to listen to all the AHS talks, but Matt's and yours and Lustig's were three that I have listened to, and they were all excellent. I felt like there was a lot of synergy there.
Thank you. Thanks. Yeah, I thought Lustig's was a... There were a ton of really, really good talks, and I think Lustig's was the grand slam home run of the AHS for sure, in my opinion. So, yeah. Well, cool. You know, we had almost 300 questions for you, so we'll start picking these things apart, and then when you're ready to tap out, we'll just can it, and then maybe we'll get you back on here in a couple of months and revisit this stuff. And as I don't know if you, I'm sure you read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because that was the first book that had any philosophy in it that I read. I was in ninth grade. My dad was actually an enlisted man in the Navy, but is a very, very bright guy. And he actually went to college after he got out of the Navy. So my dad was actually in college when I was in ninth grade and brought that book home. And I was like, what is this? It had this cool illustration on the cover, you know. And I read it for the first time in ninth grade, and I think I've read it two or three times since. And that actually got me started thinking about philosophy and philosophy of science, you know, at a pretty early age. So, yeah, that book made an impression too.
Well, and consistent with that, I'm sure you'll answer all these questions, and then you will spawn two to four questions for everyone that you answer. So we'll guaranteed end up having folks want you back on here. I'll throw this first one at you. It's a kind of a beefy one. This is from Alexa. She said, it's cool to have y'all getting Dr. Harris on the show. I've been digging his blog. My question, on the new post about fats, you list your order of preferences for optimal sources of fats He lists grass-fed ruminants first, then industrial-raised ruminants second. I've done organic heavy whipping cream in the past in my coffee and tea and love it. After getting more into Rob's stuff, I went back to black. I recently have added coconut milk in my coffee and tea to get in some extra fat rather than having snacks like nuts or fruits throughout the day. I've been on the hunt for grass-fed cream locally since reading your blog, but I can only find local goat's milk and cow's milk. Neither farm has the time or capacity for cream, so in your opinion, would you opt for organic but grain-fed milk from cows, local raw goat's milk or cow's milk, or stick with the coconut milk?
Wow, that's yeah. I'm trying to keep track of all the elements of that question there. What were the three choices at the end? It was raw goat's milk.
Well, I think it really boils down to would you recommend, you know, really gutting it out and trying to find grass fed whole cream, organic whole whipping cream, which I mean you can find that almost anywhere. Any Trader Joe's is gonna carry that. And then I think probably the final one would be non-organic whipping cream, and then we've got just standard milk at the end of that, like organic milk.
Let me answer that the way I'll answer a lot of these questions. Like I have one of my parallel lives that keeps me from blogging about nutrition is I'm a very active investor, and you know I don't have this isn't in the blogosphere so really that much, so don't go look for it. But I advise a lot of people about stuff like that, and I will usually answer questions like that by saying, I'm uncomfortable telling you what to do, but if you want to, I'll tell you what I do, and you can draw your own inferences.
Right.
So what I do is where I think it's important to have the organic meme to me doesn't mean a whole lot. I think in terms of vegetable quality, it probably does. I'm not really convinced on the dairy front that it matters that much. And I think that the thing that matters to me is pastured or grass-fed. I get butter, which is pretty similar to Kerrygold. I get it from a place in Minnesota that is pastured. Actually, that's certified organic, too. What I was going to say is the grass-fed beef and lamb that I eat is not certified organic. It could be certified organic, but, you know, it's just a bunch of bureaucracy for the farmers to, you know, they have to pay extra money to get it certified and all that stuff. So to me, that label being organic doesn't mean that much in the dairy realm. What I look for is grass-fed, because that's where you're going to have the more optimal N6-N3 ratio. You're going to have CLA. And, yeah, if they tell you at the same time we're not giving any hormones and that's of concern to you, you know, that's a bonus. But to me, just the grass-fed part matters the most. So it ought not to be that hard to find. It depends if you're in a metro area or whatnot, but yeah, where I live, so I eat, you know, all my beef, my ruminant fats, the beef and the lamb, they're all grass fed. They're not necessarily certified organic, but the farmer I know him personally doesn't use any hormones or anything. Then my butter, which is a big source of my calories, and I eat at least some of it every day. My butter is all completely grass fed, certified organic. Then probably the third source of fat for me is cream. My cream is just stuff I buy at the grocery store. So that's what I do. I mean, if that's what you want to do, that's fine. But I don't. Cream is mostly just it's mostly just fat. So, you know, your 6-to-3 ratio, if you're getting 2 or 3 tablespoons of cream a day, as long as everything else is okay, that's not really not going to affect it very much. So I don't know how much, if it's worth the effort to go to the nth degree. And increasingly, I don't go to the nth degree on a whole lot of things. And my approach has more and more gone to, you know, just avoiding things that are bad than it is to try to super optimize, you know, the things that are already good.
Right. Right. Totally agree. Good, great, great stuff. This one is from Rob with 1B. He says, there's actually 3 questions here, so I'll ping one each out to you individually. If cholesterol does not cause heart disease, what exactly does cause heart disease and heart attacks? That's like the shortest question with the longest potential answer I could possibly imagine.
Yeah, I diverted from reading and thinking about that a lot. The whole, you know, the whole carbs and insulin thing seems to be the current battlefront in the nutrition wars right now, which is something I didn't really have that much of an interest in the first place. I kind of started out more interested in heart attacks. What does cause heart attacks? Well, dietary cholesterol doesn't. Saturated fat doesn't. There are things that do. I don't think we know exactly what causes it. I could give some recent guesses. The one thing I would say to Rob with a single B is to, of all the people that I read that is skeptical of the old-fashioned diet heart hypothesis and, you know, the lipid hypothesis, there's one person that every time I read him, I think, yeah, that guy's on the right track, and that's Chris Masterjohn. So I would encourage, just go read Chris Masterjohn so we don't, you know, otherwise I could regurgitate what he says for 15 or 20 minutes. But I, with minor variations, could recommend anybody just read Chris's writings on that. And I think that's pretty close to what the truth is going to be. Chris may not talk exactly that much about specifically what you can do, but I think that, you know, there's things that come in. You know, we know there's an association with obesity and metabolic syndrome. Why would that be? Well, because I think that the association there has something to do with eating too much. And I'm going to use the dreaded phrase, energy balance. You know, energy balance meaning taking in more than goes out. I don't think that's something that happens by accident. You don't accidentally bump into calories and get fat, like some people seem to think. But I do think it's driven from the demand side, and it's affected by food quality. And what could some of those things be? Well, you know, wheat, fructose, and linoleic acid are like a mantra on my blog. Those things have something to do with overeating, something to do with having too much energy going into the system. A person with too much energy that goes into the system tends to get obese as a defense against that extra energy, coming in. That explains why a person can become diabetic without looking obviously obese, so-called skinny fat. It also explains why a person can be obese, but not, right, because they're getting fat as a defense, and they haven't started to have that excess energy status, you know, affect their inflammatory state and so on. It also probably sounds kind of vague the way I'm saying it, but I'm saying that. So, what can you do to prevent heart attacks? Clearly, if you are not eating so much that you are prone to gain weight and you're at an optimal weight and you're also not skinny fat and you don't show signs of insulin resistance, clearly that's going to do a lot to reduce the risk of heart attack. When you see people that are having heart attacks that are skinny, there's a couple things going on. One is genetics. They're probably not as genetically resistant to whatever it is that causes heart attacks. And number two, they're probably skinny fat, which is to say, if you did a CAT scan on them and looked at how much obesity they have around their organs, it's probably more than you'd think looking at them. They probably look thin, and you know, they have more fat than you think, more visceral fat than you would think. And those people are going to be more likely to have a heart attack. I think, now this is pretty speculative, but there's other people that have thought similar thoughts, including Stefan Guinet, that I think that seed oils in excess that are outside of our evolutionary experience have something to do with both atherosclerosis accelerating and probably also with the likelihood of having a heart attack. And of course, a heart attack is when you have a plaque rupture and you have thrombosis. That happens on top of atherosclerosis. So it's, you know, it's a two-step process. You can have atherosclerosis that shows up on a CAT scan or on, you know, intracoronary ultrasound and yet not have a heart attack. It's heart attack, you know, with cocaine abuse and so forth. You could have a heart attack without having atherosclerosis, but that's pretty rare. Usually it's two steps, but it is two steps. You can't just have atherosclerosis, you got to have something on top of it to have a heart attack. So what causes heart attacks? Again, I'm pretty sure eating saturated fat per se doesn't cause a heart attack. I think if we're going to point the finger at a fat that might contribute to heart attacks, it might be N6 or excess linoleic acid. You know, I'm talking eating 15% 6 versus 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6%. That might have something to do with it. that's based on epidemiology. It's based on thinking about, you know, theoretically how that could happen, but that is not even at the stage of the theory. Really, we can't really say for sure. The thing I like about reducing there is just simply absolutely no downside to it. You've got a faction out there, including, I guess, Walter Willett, who think that eating more N6 actually prevents heart attack. I think that's a pretty dangerous idea. I think that other than, you know, some of those opinions, reducing N6 as much as possible is the one thing that's completely free. I can't, you know, I just can't see any downside to it. You know, nobody says, wow, you know, drinking peanut oil, I can't give that up. I mean, people say they can't, you know, I understand why it's hard to give up bread and pizza, but who says I can't live without, you know, soy oil? That just doesn't make any sense. So trying to prevent heart attacks, you know, don't do whatever it is that makes you fat or diabetic. That's step one. Step two, I would think reducing N6. And, you know, what else can you do? I'm not sure there's a whole lot else you can do. Trying to keep proper micronutrients in your diet. I'm sure there's something to that. But, you know, we don't want to spend the whole interview talking about everything that could be done. But those would be the major things I would think of.
And maybe like a lifestyle, you know, when you're talking about energy regulation and whatnot, thinking about like a sleep debt, probably some sort of a lifestyle input that could be problematic. Vitamin D, like when we start drilling in, there's a ton of stuff.
Yeah, some of those things to me, yeah, I agree. Some of those things to me are the givens. And I constantly chastise myself for not saying get enough sleep. But I kind of picture the people that ask questions like, you know, should I go for, you know, grass-fed goat's milk? I'm assuming that they're already paying attention to things like sleep because, you know, without sleep, none of these things make any difference. I can tell you that from personal experience, being in a profession where, well, for the first, for a five-year period during my private practice career, I was on call every other night. And none of these dietary maneuvers probably would have made a whole lot of difference. I probably got more benefit out of just not being sleep deprived half of the time than anything else you could do. So I'm totally with you there, Rob. That's something I've neglected to talk about and write about. Maybe it's because, you know, I got my sleep school, you know, basically mainly by career changes and I just assume everybody's got that dialed in. But yeah, I couldn't agree more. Keeping your cortisol levels appropriate and not being exhausted is going to be key. Yeah.
You know, the obvious piece is funny because when I spent 3 months outlining my book, did all this writing, you know, banged all this stuff out, and then was sitting down looking at the book and then started getting, it's kind of funny, questions seem to come in kind of cyclic fashion. And I started getting a bunch more questions about saturated fat and cholesterol and heart disease and all that sort of stuff. And in all of my outlining and in all the process of writing the book, I never once addressed cardiovascular disease initially because it was just such an obvious deal. It's like, if you eat this way, then you're not going to get cardiovascular disease. It's just a done deal. And so I had to sit down and like, okay, so we need to include some, you know, some treatment of cholesterol and cardiovascular features, which I had completely ignored. So I'm right there with you. I can see all that. So another good question that Rob with 1B has, it seems there are a lot of reports that long, slow-distance exercise does not prevent heart attacks. What exercise does the heart want in order to fight heart disease?
Well, I think the key to understanding the whole thing with exercise is just one word, and that's hormesis. Okay, you don't, if we think of things that are hormetic, meaning it's a little bit, the definition of hormesis is something that's stressful for your body, but in a certain amount, the stress is not benefiting you, but your body's natural built-in reaction to the stress is something that makes you stronger than you would have been otherwise. So what are examples of that? Aerobic exercise, so-called aerobic exercise, I think can be a benefit. Certainly, strength training, CrossFit type stuff. Rob, I'm sure you see people get burnout or overtrained all the time. And I'm sure that you, in your explanation of why they shouldn't do that, explain that the benefit is coming when you heal or recover from the workout. It's not happening during the workout. So
right.
The reason I write posts about how long-distance running not only doesn't prevent heart attacks, but actually causes myocardial damage is because I think it does. So what amount of exercise is good for you? The answer to that is whatever amount of exercise you can recover from, and you know, pay attention to your body's response to it. If you start, I have a friend actually who, I have a couple of friends that are serious athletes, but I've got one friend who's a long distance kayaker, and he, you know, I asked him that question a long time ago. I said, how do you tell if you're overtraining? He says, it's easy. What's your resting heart rate when you first wake up in the morning? Well, mine's about 40, 48. And he said, if you find it start to creep, you know, if you find that you've made a change in your exercise routine and you're waking up in the morning, and, you know, it's 54, 56, 62, 68, and there's not some other obvious reason for it, you're probably overtraining because that's cortisol, okay? That's cortisol acting via the adrenal axis. And you got, you know, if you've got adrenaline that increasing that much when you wake up in the morning, that's a sign of overtraining. And I'm sure you know a whole bunch more signs of it than I do. You know, your ability to lift heavy weight goes down instead of up. You feel irritable, stressed, tired, you know, whatnot. So trying to put a quantitative number on it is hard. You know, again, I'll go to what I said. You know, I can't tell you what to do. I can tell you what I do. I run a 5K every other day, pretty much without fail. And no matter what else is going on with my life, that's not overtraining. I mean, even at age 50, that's not going to be overtraining. I'm going every other day without really doing much of anything that's too strenuous, and a 5K is certainly not too much. I would never argue that that's anything but good, but there's a pretty big difference between training for marathons, you know, running 50 miles a week and doing a 5K every other day. That's, you know, I'm sure the inflection point from benefit to harm is probably in there somewhere, and I don't know where it is exactly.
Yeah, I'm sure we've got some sort of a U-shaped curve on that, where some, you know, we get a training effect, we get a decrease in, you know, heart rate, we get an improvement in cardiovascular function up until a point where we don't. There was a really nice study. It was a huge study where they looked at Olympic athletes, and they just published this maybe 2 days ago, and didn't see any increased rates of cardiovascular events in everything ranging from Olympic weightlifters, wrestlers, boxers, until we started seeing the really long duration, you know, things like the marathon, triathlon, and things like that. And then you saw shocking increases in cardiovascular events, atrial fibrillation, and stuff like that.
Well, that shows you how out of touch I am. Could you send me a link to
absolutely,
that?
Absolutely, yes.
I'd love to see that, maybe even blog about it. I've got another study, too. You know, I did running, what did I call it, you know, running causes heart disease or whatever, part one and part two. There's a part three to that that I wrote part of and didn't publish yet, and that was a third study. They looked only at really hardcore marathoners and had controls that didn't run marathons, and these were guys, you know, instead of it being like the second study I talked about where it was a variety, you know, they had only run, each person had run at least two or three marathons. This is, each of them had run like a dozen marathons. And there, that was really interesting. They had, I think half to two-thirds, it was a very small study. You wouldn't think it would have enough power. I think it was a dozen in one group and a dozen in the other. And of the hardcore marathoners, half of them, now remember, these are all asymptomatic. Nobody's presented to the doctor with chest pain or had a heart attack. They had a dozen, I think, in the hardcore marathon group, and either five or six of them had myocardial damage on cardiac MRI, and of the age-matched controls, not a single one did. So silent myocardial damage happening with marathons. I think it's real. I've seen there's at least three, maybe four studies, if you count one that I've only seen in abstract form, that show this. What's the advice? Is it don't run? No, just don't run marathons. And, you know, if that paper you're alluding to now says what I think it's saying, that's pretty much saying the same thing. You know, do CrossFit a couple times a week. Don't do it every day. You know, it's pretty much common sense. Just like if radiation, you know, one of the things Steph and I both talked about is how that eating, I mean, it was Stefan that published the major, but But the reason eating lots of green leafy vegetables and stuff that has antioxidants in it is good for us is actually because of the oxidative effect that they have, and our body mounts an antioxidant response. It's not the antioxidants in the food do it. Does that effect go away if you eat 40 big-ass salads a day? I don't know. But the other things that we know that are hormetic, like exercise, too much of it is bad for you, and radiation, too much of it is bad for you. So it'd be reasonable to think for anything you think is hormesis, to think, there's some level at which, yeah, it's the U-curve, there's some amount that's better than nothing, but that doesn't mean you should just take it to extremes.
Right. I wonder how that paints juicing.
Juicing or 30 bananas a day. Yeah, exactly.
Yeesh. Yeah, that's a whole other show stuff. I dig it. Great answer on that. Joe, let's see here. Joe says, I have a question concerning your last blog post on your blog, which this was back in February. But I've always been under the impression that the brain could run efficiently on ketones. But in your post on carbohydrates, you unequivocally state that glucose is necessary for optimal brain function. Am I mistaken in my belief that you do believe that ketosis is dangerous for brain function? How would you situate ketone bodies in your classification of fuel?
Well, the thing to know is that the brain requires glucose in an obligate fashion, meaning it's not an option. The brain has to have glucose. Where ketones come in is that of the fraction of energy, instead of having it be all glucose, you can substitute, I don't know what the number is, 50 or 60%, let's say, of the energy requirement can be made up for by ketones. That's an adaptive response to starvation, okay? To the degree that being on a very low carbohydrate diet or in constant ketosis all the time, I'm going to take a tangent here that doesn't directly answer the question.
We like tangents.
What's that?
We love tangents.
Okay, well, I'll try not to make it too long. We just got done talking about hormesis, okay? This answers the question when people say, why don't you think you should be in ketosis all the time? If ketosis is good for you, why shouldn't you just stay on a ketogenic diet? Because it's hormesis. It's hormetic. It's hormetic to be on a to be in ketosis. It's probably hormetic to do intermittent fasting. It's probably hormetic to have reduced meal frequency or, go 16 or 18 hours every day without a meal versus snacking, right? That's probably hormetic. Taken to extreme, it's called Auschwitz. It's called starvation, right? That's the extreme of not eating. In the same sense, I think ketosis is good for us to do once in a while. It's something that naturally occurred during our evolution. Occasionally, I don't buy the 50 gene hypothesis, but I'm just saying periods without food were not that unusual. And so it's logical that that might be good for us. But staying in ketosis all the time is not good for us just because some ketosis is good for us. Now, back to the question. Regarding the brain, in order to conserve glucose, and why do you want to conserve glucose? We want to conserve glucose because when we're not eating glucose, what do we use to turn into glucose? We use protein. We use amino acids. Where do they come from? They come from our muscles, right? So instead of tearing down muscle, your body's thinking, well, there's a natural turnover of amino acids. Even if you're not doing anything, it's turnover. We want to be able to put amino acids back into the muscle to keep the muscle up rather than divert amino acids to glucose. So to the degree that we can take energy from both of my understanding of it, it's been a while, you're diverting energy both from amino acids and from fatty acids in order to make ketone bodies, right? So to the degree you cannot use up the amino acids and burn ketone bodies, instead you're sparing the glucose. Why do you need to spare the glucose? For the brain. You're actually making the glucose, the brain has the ability to burn ketones, so but it can last longer on the fuel tank of, you know, the fuel tank of glucose that it's got. Whatever the source of the glucose we have is going to last longer. That's an adaptive response. Now, the second part of that is it so happens that neurodegenerative diseases, a whole bunch of them, I would probably refer you to Emily Dean's blog, Evolutionary Psychology, or I'm sorry, Evolutionary Psychiatry, for more detail about this. But what happens in a variety of neurodegenerative diseases is function very well in handling energy. We've often called Alzheimer's diabetes of the brain. It seems to be characterized by inability to handle energy substrates efficiently. One of the cures for all of these, and you can include Alzheimer's, I've heard of Huntington's, Parkinson's disease, maybe the variety of Parkinson's dementias that are not Parkinson's disease, anything where you've got neuronal dysfunction can theoretically be helped to the degree it has something to do with not handling energy substrates by substituting ketones for glucose. So that's why, even though I say a normal person should not all the time because it's too much hormesis, which is bad, a person who has a neurodegenerative disease may, because of the way their brain functions, may function better by substituting ketones for glucose 24/7. So then you're getting into a therapeutic ketogenic diet, which to me is the same as saying, you know, you're type 2 diabetes, you've lost beta cell function, now you may benefit from being on Dr. Bernstein's diet. That doesn't mean that everybody should go on Dr. Bernstein's diet. That's how I look at that.
And I'm glad you tied that around because definitely this is the emergent kind of refinement of all this understanding. You know, I know for me, just being in a gym and having come out of a research area that was really focused on lipid metabolism and autoimmunity and cancer, everybody that I was exposed to was insulin-resistant type 2 diabetics, like just virtually across the board. And even if they weren't diagnosed as type 2 diabetics, all that they needed to do was wander into their doctor and they would be anointed type 2 diabetic. And so everybody that I encountered had this same problem. A low-carb, paleo-type diet was the solution. So then, you know, like they always had a hammer on surgeons, you know, if you only have a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. Sure. Definitely my whole world basically boiled down to, well, low-carb, you know, ketogenic-type diet is the cure for all problems. And then you start getting into a population of people that are doing, say, like CrossFit and some stuff like that, very glycogen-demanding activities. Yep. And we start getting some hypercorticism and some other problems as a spinoff of that, because fundamentally we've got a completely different scenario.
Sure. And, you know, my own experience with low carb, I wouldn't say I was on a ketogenic diet. I was on, you know, kind of like a Lutz's diet, you know, life without bread, maybe I would say 70 grams or less of carbs, but sometimes as low as 30 or 40. And I'll tell you, I'm not making this up, I had no adverse symptoms at all, except for two, okay? I could, if I had a little bit of orthostasis, my blood pressure was a little low. If I, let's say I go to the bookstore after a workout while fasting, okay, and I reach down to the magazine, you know, I squat down to grab a magazine and I stand up real fast, for about 2 seconds I'd be a little lightheaded, okay? That was the only symptom I ever had, a very low-carb diet for 2 years steady. So I didn't know exactly why that was. I lost weight. I didn't know it was I liked that before. I didn't really think of it much until it went away. The only reason I raised my carb intake initially was not because, you know, I read some blogger saying I'm going to die, or because I had some, you know, tachyarrhythmia, or because, you know, I was gaining weight. It was actually just the opposite. I had always worked out, you know, just a couple times a week, this kind of maintenance workout that I could talk about where just maybe 3 times a week I run a 5K. When I go lift weights, mostly upper body, you know, vanity type, middle-aged guy workout, you know, just to kind of keep myself in shape. I had no problem at all doing that with almost hardly any carbs in the diet. What did it for me was over a year ago, I had a building that needed a whole bunch of work done on it. And now we're talking about work like manual labor, blue-collar work, which I am certainly no stranger to. I've been doing that kind of stuff since I was 12 years old. So I go over there, and I don't want to hire anybody. So basically, I spent about 60 hours a week repairing things, climbing up and down ladders, and painting. You know, so I'm working really, and what happened was I just started to drop. My initial weight before I ever started all this was about 170 pounds on a 5'11 frame. And, you know, people said, you thought I was skinny back then, but I had a gut, you know. And I went down over about the course of 6 months eating low carb. I went down to about 149, 152 pounds, something like that. And what happened when I did this intense manual labor was I just couldn't keep it on. I didn't have enough appetite to keep the weight on. And I dropped, I guess, in maybe 2 weeks, I dropped from 152 down to maybe 145. And I didn't look good. You know, I was looking, some people think in some of the pictures I posted, I look like Auschwitz anyway, but I really didn't look good. I looked older, you know, lost sub-Q fat. And I thought, well, this is pretty obvious to me. I need more energy. Well, it's the easiest way. Go do it in reverse. Add carbohydrates. So that, from this Rice Krispies comment, I thought, well, what's a benign carb that, you know, I can use to add carbs to my diet? I just ate a big giant bowl or two sometimes of Rice Krispies in the morning, added about 70 to 80 grams of carbs, and the weight loss. And I gained it back over about the next month or two, I would say. And at that point, my carb intake was probably, it had been, let's say it had been 7% before. I would estimate it went up to maybe 15%. Okay. So then at that point, I noticed, okay, my weight came back exactly to about 152, something like that. And then over the next couple months, I kept eating that way. It came back to about 155. So we're at 15% carbs, okay? Remember, I started at 170. We're at 15% carbs now, and my weight's 155. And for the first time, I noticed this orthostasis went away. Again, it was never anything I would have sought help for or even made the connection. It's like, oh, it went away. I'm convinced it's good to have some carbs in the diet, especially if you're super active. You know, by that time, I had stopped, you know, all this intense manual labor, but I just kept eating that way. So then I took the experiment further, and I thought, okay, let's see if the macronutrient ratio really is the thing that does it. I'm going to keep eating no wheat. I'm going to keep not eating excess linoleic acid, and I'm going to limit the added fructose, okay? So, you know, I'll eat an orange or, you know, whatnot now and then, but I'm not going to be adding sugar to my diet, and still no liquid calories, including milk. I haven't drank milk for 3 years. Add cream to the coffee, but no milk. So what I did was, and you're probably hearing it here first, but I raised my carb intake to the 40 to 50% range. Now, that's not really that high. That's not, you know, Katabin-level carbs. But when I weighed 170, my carb intake was probably only 40%. I was already eating a lot of meat and so forth. So the result of that experiment was I went back to a carb fraction at or higher than what I started at. And yesterday morning I weighed myself and I'm 154 pounds. So 16 pounds of weight loss maintained with a carb fraction with, okay, this morning the only thing I had to eat, I ate two bananas and I had a little bit of cream in my coffee. I have rice or potatoes with virtually every meal, and I'm guessing 40 to 45% of my calories is carbs. I still eat plenty of, you know, all the fat I get is still animal fat. All I've done is just backed off on some of the, the butter cream. Basically, the fat content is the same constituents, but it's gone down, and I've added substituted starch for animal fats. And to me, that's the lesson, is on an evolutionary basis, we are designed to eat either starch or animal fat, and it's a horse apiece. You can toggle between the two in your diet, the same way that your cells can toggle between fatty acids and glucose. And I don't think that's an accident. I think we're designed to eat that way. So there you have it. That was my macronutrient experiment. And that's what, you know, put the nail in the coffin for me as far as the carbohydrate hypothesis. I always said, I don't think it matters that much, but I had to do it myself before I could say, wow, yeah, you can really maintain your weight loss just eating a whole foods paleo type or real foods diet. I don't think the element there that makes most people lose the weight is starch. The element is that a low carb diet reduces neolithic agents of disease, as I call them, and it also, and maybe especially, reduces this food reward thing, which is something Steph blogs about and which I'm a believer in, at least in terms of it being a way that you can lose weight. So another long-winded answer for you there.
I dig it. And I'm sure that Greg could probably warm up to the Rice Krispies breakfast pretty quickly. So, but sure. I know a bunch of people are going to want to know, what did you eat your Rice Krispies in, if not milk?
Oh, yeah. Usually it's half and half. So you can tote up, it might be fractionally slightly low on the protein there. But, there's plenty of fat there, lots of calories. I don't sprinkle sugar on it. It's generic or brand Rice Krispies. There might be 2 grams of sucrose in a giant bowl. It's mostly just plain old toasted starch from the Rice Krispies. And then the rest of it's half and half. I'm going to ballpark and say, you know, if you use a pretty big bowl, you know, you're probably talking about how much? Maybe 50 grams of starch. It's like probably a cup and a half of the Rice Krispies. And you're probably looking at probably 400 calories from the half and half. You could just do whole cream if you're afraid of, you know, casein and stuff like that, too. That would work. Yep. And it's fast. It's fast and convenient. You know, it's quick and dirty.
Yeah, it is. Greg, could you warm up to that for breakfast?
Yeah, although I was kind of hoping he was going to go Revenge of the Nerds style and just pour beer into it. I guess we could work with half and half.
Yeah. Wasn't that what Booger had?
Yeah. Cheerios with beer, I think.
I could warm up to that. I'd be pretty excited about that.
I mean, you can get gluten-free beer. It's not a big deal.
It's true. It's true. Breakfast of champions, for sure. I dig it. Okay, so ABP says, dairy, Wolf and Harris in a cage. Go.
What was that? Dairy? Berries?
Dairy, yeah. Wolf and Harris in
dairy.
A cage. You know, it's really funny. Mark Sisson was super kind and had me on his site a couple of weeks ago. And there's this funny thing out there because my kind of protocol is remove grains, legumes, dairy, go 30 days, reintroduce, see how you do. And because I set up this 30-day roadblock where I'm like, why don't you see if you are really reactive to this stuff and then reintroduce? Because I make that recommendation, apparently I'm the anti-dairy guy. Now, I think a lot of people end up having problems with it, and I think that a large majority of people end up discovering that they do better without it than with it. They discover that butter and cream is either benign or only minorly irritating. Some people not so. They end up noticing a lot of problems with it. But it's funny. There's this perception that I'm just like the anti-dairy dude across the board when it's really just a thing of, I make the exact same recommendation with corn, but nobody's up in arms about me saying you should remove corn for 30 days and then reintroduce. So.
Yeah, Rob, it seems like, you know, we're both aware that it's nearly impossible to separate describing what we do from describing what we recommend as well. And in my case, I'm perceived as the pro-dairy guy because I eat it. Even though I keep saying over and over, you know, your mileage may vary. If it bothers you, don't eat it. Substitute something else. The same thing with VLC. I'm painted as the VLC guy because for 2 years I ate VLC. But I don't remember once ever telling somebody they had to eat VLC. The first time somebody said, what do you eat? You know, and I wrote a post. I said, the first thing I said is, this is what I eat, not necessarily what you should eat. It works for me. You have to pay attention to N equals 1 in terms of if it obviously is bad. I mean, you can't use the N equals one meme to tell if it's good for you, but you certainly can tell if it's bad. I mean, if it if it is obvious, if there's something obviously wrong, you need to, you know, suss out what it is in your diet that's causing that. But one of the hang-ups for me with telling people, yeah, go ahead and eliminate the dairy, is, you know, before I came around to thinking starches are definitely okay, you know, the question is, well, if you're not going to eat dairy and you're not going to eat grains and you're not going to eat legumes, what exactly are you going to eat? It's pretty hard, actually, to get lots, to get up to 40 or 50% carbs, to say nothing of 60 or 70%, is basically impossible without so-called safe starches. You just can't do it. So now I can see how it's much easier to eliminate dairy than I thought it might be, because the easiest thing to do is to say, well, if it's okay to eat, you know, Rice Krispies or something made with rice flour, some kind of, you know, candy cigarette made with rice flour, or if you're going to eat plantains or bananas or, you know, basically starchy fruits or sweet potatoes or white potatoes, it becomes pretty easy to take dairy out of the diet then. In fact, I tried it myself, a la your recommendation, tried nearly eliminating it for a month, made absolutely no difference one way or the other. So I'm a person that my dairy consumption is pretty much limited to butter and very small aliquots of cream. I've never really been a milk drinker. But I don't think, you know, on the big thing of the whole theme of dairy causes cancer, causes heart attacks, I still don't buy any of that. I just haven't seen the evidence for it. But I have no difficulty at all with saying, as induction to, you know, paleo way of eating, totally eliminate dairy, because as long as you're allowing starches in there and not trying to go low carb, you're going to starve yourself if you try to go low carb and no dairy at the same time. You're either going to be eating too many PUFAs or something else is not going to be right. But if you're willing to do it with a decent component of starchy, you know, plant matter, then I don't see any problem to it at all. So maybe there's been some convergence there. And, you know, no cage match is necessary.
Well, funny enough, we have round two of the Harris Wolf cage battle vegetables go. that one was from
vegetables.
Mises.
Okay, vegetables agnostic. And I don't mean agnostic in the sense people use, like when they talk about, you know, believing in God, they use agnostic as a nice term for somebody that's actually an atheist but won't admit it. I mean actually agnostic. I don't really know what the optimal level of vegetables is. I know that the people that say, we should eat nothing but meat and water are completely insane. And I know that I don't think that Dr. McDougall or what's his name, begins with an F, I can't remember, the disciple of I can't even think of the vegan guys. You know, I don't think being a vegan and eating like a gorilla is optimal either. Where it is in between, I think, is best summarized by, I did that post called William Money Eats His Vegetables, which to me brought it all together and explains why vegetables are good for you, not because you have to eat vegetables, but because it's better. There's some hormesis in having a variety of plant chemicals in your diet. There probably is some benefit to, you know, the fiber, insoluble fiber. But when we say, you know, vegetables or fruits and vegetables, usually we have this idea in our mind of a Marxism big-ass salad. It's got a whole big variety in it. So I assume, you know, your questioner is wanting us to fight over that. You know, how many colorful vegetables do we need? If we include vegetables to be, starchy plant organs, there's usually plenty of soluble fiber in that. So then it would just come down to how many, you know, putatively important micronutrients and how much hormesis are you getting from the colorful variety thing. My own diet really doesn't have a huge amount of colorful variety in it. I probably have, you know, a green salad with a whole bunch of, you know, colorful stuff in it maybe three or four times a week. You know, so again, if you want to do what I do, that's what you could do. But there's no particular reason I eat that way. It has more to do with, you know, I don't really like to make salads because I'm lazy and my wife makes them better than I do. So how often does my wife make a salad pretty much determines how often I eat salads. It's got little to do with thinking I'm going to die if I don't eat them or that I think plants are all poison. Yeah, it's just kind of there.
Right. It's funny. For a long time, especially when I was much more in the you know, real low carb camp, tried to get a ton of vegetable matter. I had improved digestion because of not having grains and stuff like that in general, but still had a little bit of digestive issues. And since I've really mitigated the amount of vegetable matter I get outside again of like, I do a lot of yams and sweet potatoes, like orange and yellow and purple and all that sort of jive. Digestion is better. I don't spend as much time in the kitchen. I don't spend as much time eating, and I'm not as annoyed by my meals. Like, I just kind of, I get a piece of meat, I get a yam or a sweet potato, I throw some pastured butter on it. Oh my God, the anti-dairy guy is eating butter. And, you know, it's easy, it's delicious, and I'm like, dude, I could eat this way for 100 years. You know, I have no problem with it. And the anxiety around whether or not I'm micronutrient deficient, at this point, I just don't care.
Well, I think that
if I'm going to die next week, I just don't care. You know,
So you're not, and that's one of the things you can kind of, if you're into the, you have to avoid X, X, and X, and you have to be low carb at the same time. Yeah, that can lead to some funny things like really expensive grocery bills where you have, you know, giant sacks of groceries full of really expensive plant matter, and you're worried about getting them in the right combination. And, you know, what are you going to eat if you're low carb but you're not eating bread? You know, and or even, you know, that's the problem. If you take the starchy vegetables, the potatoes out, which have a lot of good micronutrients, and also have the soluble fiber that might be good for us. You kind of end up doing some contortions that don't really seem to mimic what a real ancestral diet would have been, the way I know about it. So yeah, I'm all in favor of flexibility and variety.
I'm looking through the questions here. We're at an hour. Can you hang with us for a little bit longer?
Like, I can go as long as you can tolerate me.
Cool, Greg. Are you good for a little bit longer too?
Yeah, I can tolerate both you guys for a while.
I think Greg just puts us on mute, and then when he sees the signal not coming in on the voice side, he's like, okay, and I'm back. let's see here. This one I kind of like from Adam. Dr. Harris, you've mentioned there isn't as strong of evidence against legumes and dairy. We kind of hammered the dairy. Let's talk about legumes a little bit versus other Neolithic dangers. Can you discuss that?
Well, I think I go back to, you know, not having, I mean, I've done some quite a bit of digging on dairy, and it's more just, you know, I'll read a paper and go, and that doesn't really convince me. You know, I don't have a paper that's a reverse smoking gun that says, you know, oh, this is proof dairy's okay. I think that's impossible. But nothing I've seen in epidemiology or any of the laboratory science convinces me that dairy as a whole is as big a concern as wheat. Legumes, I would say this. I'm reasonably suspicious of wheat, but not as suspicious as I used to be, maybe surprisingly. I try to avoid it because it's easy to avoid, and I don't crave bread. I think it may be that flour is hyperpalatable. Flour has kind of a concentrated bunch of gluten in it, so that if you're not actually celiac, how big an issue is wheat? I would actually, in my hierarchy of NADs, I'd probably put massively excess PUFAs first, massively excess sugar second. I don't know, maybe one's ahead of the other, depends on how much you're talking about. And by massively excess, you know, I think you could probably reasonably eat quite a bit of fruit, if it's not watermelon. You know, fruit that's actually got a 50-50 ratio between glucose and fructose. You know, oranges, stuff like that. Bananas is actually more starch than fructose, but it's got some in it. You could eat a reasonable amount of fruit, and maybe up to like 50 grams a day of added sugar, and I doubt seriously if that would be bad for you unless you're diabetic, okay? So, you know, I'm not a total Nazi about fructose consumption, but when you're getting, I literally know people, I know a guy that's addicted to Mountain Dew, and I actually sat down and calculated he's getting 40% of his total caloric, no, I'm sorry, 35% of his total calories from fructose, not from sugar, from fructose. He drinks so much Mountain Dew. It's like two, I may have that wrong, but it's like whatever it would be, 2 liter, one of those 2 liter containers, 1.5 of those a day or something. He drinks so much Mountain Dew. He just drinks Mountain Dew all day. So next in the hierarchy would be wheat, okay? So I've set you up there to say, you know, wheat is probably the least important NAD per se. White flour may be different. White flour may have effects that help make it hyperpalatable. It's usually combined, obviously, with added sugar, even with linoleic acid. If you talk about the, you know, the birthday cake example, if you go buy birthday cake at Hy-Vee, it's literally, I think Matt Lalonde even made a comment like this, you know, there are certain junk foods that literally combine all the worst NADs in exactly the wrong proportions, you know, and you can eat that way. So if I think wheat is probably number three, what does that do with the status of legumes? Well, you know, by inference, I must not think legumes is that bad if wheat is no longer number one but number three. And you know, I'm talking like whole wheat, properly prepared, all that. So I, you know, when you look at stuff like black beans or pinto beans, as long as they're cooked properly, To me, the lectin and anti-nutrient issue in those is not that big a deal. It seemed to me that when we initially, and I say we, I mean the paleo movement that I may or may not be a part of, you know, Dr. Cordain's early books seemed oriented towards saying part of the reason all of this stuff was problematic was because of the starch or carbohydrate content. Well, if we decided that the starch is no longer bad, but starch was okay to begin with, then that removes that. Then we're saying, well, what is it that's really bad about beans? It's anti-nutrients. But as Matt Lalonde alluded to in his AHS talks, you're gonna make yourself look foolish if you talk about anti-nutrients when you realize that sweet potatoes have more than white potatoes. You know, when you add them all up, it's just kind of which ones are they? Are we? So, you know, the anti-nutrient thing has to be account for cooking. And it has to account for the species, and it has to account for the person. So I haven't gone digging through the literature, but my suspicion level of legumes is low. It's low enough that occasionally when I do a New York strip, I'll take a can of overcooked black beans and make a black bean paste and put it on the top, and it's delicious. And I don't think of that as the same as eating bread. I just don't see how. There's too many cultures. There's too many Mesoamerican cultures in the Americas that practice agriculture where they had, you know, not only maize, what we call corn, but, you know, beans, starch. And, you know, as long as they weren't eating that exclusive to animal products, they seemed to do pretty okay with that and probably didn't have a lot of cancer or diabetes or heart attacks. So it's pretty hard for me to be as suspicious of legumes as I have of wheat, when the best example we have of wheat is to look at the ancient Egyptians, where they had, you know, they didn't have modern processed food, but we know they ate a lot of wheat, maybe even a lot of seed oils, and we have pretty good mummy evidence of atherosclerosis in those people. You know, that's not definitive, obviously, but What do you think, Rob? Where are you with legumes?
You know, they're definitely orders of magnitude less problematic than wheat. I definitely still keep, for me, that one's still, you know, like same three, you know, baddies, the linoleic acid, fructose, and kind of gluten-containing items. I call them Satan's excrement, just, you know, or Satan's trifecta or something like that. But the only people that I've seen really problematic with legumes, folks with autoimmune disease, like they have an overt autoimmune kind of condition going on. And a lot of people with GERD, legumes, even when they're properly prepared, seem to potentially be problematic. But it's that thing again of, you know, eliminate, reintroduce. And like for me, I'll have bean, you know, I'll have corn two or three times a week, and I could probably eat corn every day and have no problems from it. Beans are a little bit different for me. Like, I get some acid reflux from black beans, pinto beans. Don't have a problem really with lentils, but black beans and pinto beans, I'll get some acid reflux almost immediately from those guys, even okay. if I sprout them, pressure cook them myself. So it's just, for me, it's definitely orders of magnitude less bad. And it's just in that same caveat of like, hey, let's just pull it out of the rotation, reintroduce, see how you do, because we, you know, there's some suspicion there, but we really don't know. And then, like you've said, it offers enough food variety that if you don't have a problem with it, then just for making life easy and not being a complete freak when you're out and about, you know, eating with other people, then it just kind of diversifies your options a lot.
For sure. I would point out, too, that a lot of the times we identify relatively immediate reactions to foods that we're suspicious of, and this would include wheat-containing products and legumes. You're probably dealing with FODMAPs and not gluten. Obviously, mm-hmm. there isn't gluten in black beans, but those fermentable, you know, I'm not going to reel off a whole acronym, but basically stuff that ends up being fermented in your colon. If it's contributing to SIBO, you know, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, I think that's something that could be very individual. It may have something to do with how disturbed it may have something to do with the history of your gut biota. It could be that if you ate black beans for a while, you would adapt to it and have no problem and not have any reflux. Or it could be that maybe your gut biota is permanently altered by the modern lifestyle and now you can't eat black beans anymore. So I think that when people say, oh, I can't tolerate this wheat-containing thing because it's got gluten in it, well, probably it's the FODMAP issue if you're really having some kind of immediate reaction to it. I know that one issue for me is peaches because they're full of polyols, alcohols, and I can eat, quite a variety of different fruits without any problem. But if I eat, you know, peaches, especially ripe, they'll bug me bad. And it's too bad because they're kind of tasty. But
that's really interesting. We ate at a place, Tune-Up Cafe in Santa Fe, just a couple of days ago, and the guy had some amazing pork spare ribs. He said, yeah, it's totally gluten-free. And the barbecue sauce, though, was actually a peach reduction. And it was amazing, but it felt a ton like what I would normally characterize as kind of not exactly, but similar to a gluten cross-reaction. And it was almost immediate. But I didn't get, when I get a gluten exposure, I get kind of some neurological symptoms, some weird vision. I mean, I'm pretty reactive to the gluten stuff, but it was kind of similar. And I was telling Nikki, I'm like, you know, it feels a little bit like that, but it's not it. And the dude swore that the whole thing was gluten free because typically they're really good about that. And I wasn't aware of the polyols and the peaches that. And if you do a reduction, you know, you're just concentrating the heck out of that stuff.
Yeah, not to mention adding some fructose to it too. And I would remind people that. It's normal. Okay, nobody has fructose malabsorption when you're talking about fruit. You know, even frankenfruit that we have now, you just can't eat fruit fast enough to overwhelm your digestive system with fructose. I agree with Lustig on that. I'm not saying you should eat 30 bananas a day or live on fruit. I don't think you need fruit to survive or to live or cancer if you don't eat fruit. But fruit is pretty benign. I don't think that... you can cause yourself that much harm with most fruit. But when you take and abstract the sucrose out of it, which is what you're doing with cane sugar, if you take a giant bolus, I'm trying to remember the exact statistic, I don't want to misquote it, but I think a bolus of 75 grams of sucrose, is it fructose or sucrose? I think it's 75 grams or more of sucrose, of fructose, yeah, 75 grams of sucrose, 50% of the normal asymptomatic population will have a positive hydrogen breath test if you give it to them. That means that's malabsorption. So it's normal to malabsorb fructose. And that is going to go to the colon, could cause SIBO, could cause abnormal growth of the commensal organism that we know as, it's on the tip of my tongue, you know, the one that everybody has in their gut that's associated with
H. pylori and all that.
I keep wanting to say Giardia, but it's H. pylori. Yeah, so Giardia or H. pylori is supposed to be a commensal organism, and it probably overgrows when you have hydrogen bubbling backwards in the gut from the abnormal fermentation that's going on in the distal small bowel. It's probably a gut biota thing that might make you susceptible. But I would just add that eating too much fructose at once, like, you know, drinking a Coca-Cola real fast, could cause the same kind of symptoms as, you know, eating something that's got FODMAPs in it, because F is fructose in the, or, you know, F is fermentable, and among the FODMAPs is fructose itself if you give a high enough dose. And that's true, like I say, 50% of the normal population. It's fructose malabsorption. It's not the analog of the thing with lactose. It's normal to malabsorb fructose if you eat too much at once.
So, interesting. This one's a little bit more, it's not so foodie. This is from Dr. Pierce. It says, Dr. Harris, thanks for taking the questions for the upcoming podcast. Although recently introduced to your blog, I'm a big fan. My question concerns talking to other healthcare providers. These providers are very educated, but despite all the evidence I can provide, they still deny that there is any merit to the philosophy and science of paleo nutrition. Do you have any advice on how to talk to other doctors, PTs, etc., without being offensive, especially when it concerns patient care?
Not really. this is just, Rob, this just becomes a function of age. Your desire and willingness to fight and beat your head against the wall just diminishes, I think, the older you get. And I try not to call it cynicism, but maybe it's a little bit of, maybe it's just exhaustion, not cynicism. It's just not productive to try to convince people that don't want to be convinced. I think most of these dietary things we're talking about are things that can be handled without even interacting with your physician about it. And I'm a physician, okay? And my success with convincing other physicians to pay attention to any of this has been very, very limited. I'm talking about people that I know personally where I say, hey, read this book. Tell me what you think. You know, they don't even crack it. They're too busy. They're too busy, you know, trying to make money with Medicare paying them, you know, $9 for an office visit. I mean, you know, the vagaries of just dealing with the healthcare system and practicing medicine are just too much. The only thing that allowed me to be able to have the time to even get absorbed in this, to be totally honest, the genesis of this for me was a failing business. I had an imaging center that went gangbusters for the first 3 years that I had it. And then it slowed down to the point that I could sit in my office and read papers and, you know, sometimes blog. That's the God's truth of how I came to this. If I was a normal radiologist, I'd be so overwhelmed with work that I wouldn't have time to read it all outside my specialty. So I don't know. I don't know how to convince people. I really don't. I could make up some answer, you know, grab them by the lapels, you know, shake them. But I don't know if. If you have any ideas, I'm all ears.
No, I think I'm very much in the same boat as you. Denise had a really, really good piece, you know, how to convince or how to argue with a vegan or a vegetarian at the AHS. And it was really good. She's a great speaker. She's going to be a real heavy hitter with all this stuff in the coming years. But, you know, I piped in that I think it's just a absolute waste of time to try to convince anybody, you know, like present whatever material you can. And, you know, at this point, like I told those folks then, which I think the sense that I've had there's been some kind of somewhat cranky tweeting about my commentary on that, you know, that we need to get in and argue with these folks. We have so many people that are interested in this topic, and we have so many people that legitimately want help, that if you just spend your time helping the people that want help, then you end up building this base of people that get good results, and then we can actually do something with that, whether we're talking about funding independent research or a variety of different things, versus getting into a you know, knockdown dragout with these folks. And it's interesting, Tom Naughton was there at her talk at the same time, and he mentioned a paper, I think it was in a philosophy journal or a logic journal or something like that, and it basically made the point that it does not matter how good your argument is. It is virtually, it never occurs that two people sit down with differing views and then two people walk away with the same views. Like it just doesn't happen. And so your best time spent, I think, is just kind of putting the information out there to the people that are intrigued by it. And then that's it. Cause you're just not going to change anybody's mind unless they're at least somewhat open to the idea.
Yeah. To borrow again from an anecdote that I read in some book on Buddhism, you know, and I was comparing Buddhism to, you know, proselytizing religions. It's the banquet metaphor, okay? You spread a table, you put a tablecloth down, you lay out all these different, you know, paleo goods, and you say, come and eat it. Don't come and spit on the table. You know, don't tip it over. Don't pull the tablecloth out. You're welcome to eat all you want, but you can't force anybody to do it. You can't force anybody to eat it and say it's tasty or even to look at it. All you can do is lay it out. And that's what I do on my blog when I blog. I'm surprised you haven't asked me why I'm not blogging anymore. But
we're going to get that out again. So,
yeah, fair enough. But what you know, what I'm doing is I'm just laying it out, and I try to say over and over again, it's just one man's opinion, not even just the doctor's opinion. It's just one guy's opinion. There's enough people that literally call me on the phone and say, "What do you think about this?" That, you know, why not just put it out there? I'll let people read it. I have in common with, you know, Peter Hyperlipid, that I'm not trying to save the world, because the world doesn't want to be saved. It just it just doesn't. And every hour you spend helping somebody that doesn't want your help is an hour that you're not spending helping somebody that does want your help, even if you don't know who that person is yet. So why give advice to people that don't want it? They don't want it. If they don't want it. And that's where I am with the vegans thing. You know, when I read blogs, I don't even read blogs unless I think there's some common agreement there, okay? I'm alluding to something that you might be smart enough to figure out, but I don't go to a blog unless, like, we're speaking the same language or we're in the same realm of inquiry. I defy you to go anywhere on the internet and find where I said, no, you're full of shit, your whole premise is wrong, you know, this is, you know, you're wrong, you're a vegan, you're this, you're that, you're, you know, all the, call them the zero car people, you know, they came to my blog. I didn't go to their blogs, right, or websites or forums. I don't do that. Why? Is it out of respect for them? No, it's out of respect for me. I don't waste my time commenting or even meeting at places where I have no common ground. I don't go to places that discuss UFOs. I don't go to places that talk about, you know, creationism. It doesn't interest me. It's a waste of time. I used to be kind of interested in arguing with people and saying, don't you see? But I'm too old for that now. I just get tired of it. So I don't.
I must have aged less effectively than you, because I'm about 10 or so years younger, and I am 100% there. So,
but Rob, you're about 100 in internet years, because you've been doing this for like a decade for real, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, since 98, 99. So yeah, totally. Yeah. And I've definitely spent a ton of time, you know, assailing the vegans and you know, bouncing around American Dietetic Association websites, and to absolutely no good effect. And then when I just hunkered in and I was like, hey, I think this topic is important, and I'd write on it and I'd get some feedback. And then all of a sudden, it started getting a bunch of traffic and things started happening, and ironically started actually helping a lot of people. And, and you know, that's kind of the irony there. And instead of, you know, doing anything other than just trying to produce some good work that I myself found interesting just in the process of making it, then I actually started reaching out and helping some people, and wasn't I both annoyed and annoying, I think. So yeah, it's an interesting deal.
Yeah. And you have done just a world of good. I listen, you know, like I said, yours is one of the AHS talks I listened to. I thought it was just real, really cool. You know, it was your typical self-effacing persona. That's the real you. And it was a great big tent kind of talk. I really liked it. It was good.
Oh, thanks. But we've got a couple more here, and then we'll let you go. Greg's probably about ready to, like, impale himself on a pencil or something like that. We haven't mentioned Olympic weightlifting or anything at all yet, so Greg's probably about ready to check out. But Sergey asks, Kurt, you recently mentioned that excess omega-3 is almost as bad as excess omega-6. Is it possible to get too much omega-3 from simply eating too much oily fish like mackerel or salmon? Let's take an extreme case. A person does not eat meat, but only eats lots of fish.
Yeah, okay. So my issue with omega-3 is it's not that I think it's possible to have too much omega-3 in your cell membrane. Because remember, when we talk about those eicosanoid pathways, you've got certain choke points there that are kind of agnostic to what kind of, you've got the fatty acid of unsaturated fatty acid of a given chain length, and that enzyme is agnostic to whether it's getting a 6 or a 3. So what it does is it takes those out of the cell membrane pretty much stochastically or statistically in proportion to how they are represented in the membrane. So let me be clear. It's good to have the proper ratio in your membranes. The problem is, what's the Gilbert and Sullivan thing? You know, many a slip between the cup and the lip. How do we get there? How do we get from what we want? How do we get from the diet to the membrane? I still maintain the optimal, the best way to get it there is to not be overstoking your membranes with N6s. That's way more important, more effective, probably safer in a fail-safe sense, in a first minimal harm sense, to do it that way than it is to do it by trying to pack the membranes with N3s. Okay, so to me, the place that the ratio, and Chris pretty much agree with, our three, my views are kind of derivative of theirs, independent but also derivative based on them as usual, giving me lots of references that I read. But that's the best way to do it. If you're going to try to bias it towards the N3s, that is not just not have too many N6s, it seems to me that the best way to do that is with our real food, because a fresh caught fish that I just pulled out of the 45 degree water of Lake Michigan yesterday is pretty obviously going to be a safer, more reliable source of omega-3s that haven't degraded or become oxidized or contaminated or whatever than, taking it in pill form. Now, there are arguments that I'm sympathetic to that taking it in pill form is going to... The concern for me is that even if you have a pill that, it's all packed right and it's not oxidized, the thing is, total PUFA matters as well as 6-3. And as far as your liver is concerned, 3s are better than 6s, but there's some experimental evidence I'm aware of that you can increase the oxidized LDL, maybe, and you can increase, you can have negative effects on the liver just with total PUFA, not just with the 3s. So again, I think the best thing is just don't eat too many 6s. Do I think fish, it's possible to get too many 3s via fish? Well, there's the whole, ethological anecdote about Eskimos actually eating so much N3 for marine sources that their bleeding time is affected. Mm-hmm. I think it's probably not optimal. I think it would be not optimal to have a length of the bleeding time relative to normal. So I think, yeah, it's theoretically possible if you eat nothing but oily cold water fish as your protein source, that might be bad. In real life, do I think that's very likely to happen to a person that starts off on the SAD or has already saturated not just cell membranes, but tissues are already saturated with N6. Do I think that's possible to get so much N3 that it affects your bleeding time? It's probably not very likely in a North American or a Western person that could happen. Is it possible to have too much oxidation going on from just too much N6, from too much total PUFA from eating fish? Possible, but not very likely. I think eating fish in almost any amount is probably perfectly safe, so I wouldn't worry about that. I myself, in addition to getting the, all the pretty much one-to-one ratio of N3s to N6s, that I get in my grass-fed ruminant fat. I also eat fish about 3 times a week, you know, frozen cod. People give me fresh caught cold water Chinook. I think they're Chinook Pacific salmon. They're from Lake Michigan, literally right outside my window. So I eat a fair amount of fish. I think, you know, in order of preference, you know, probably eating fish a couple times a week and not eating a lot of N6s is probably the number one choice, you know, over fish pills or anything.
Gotcha. Doc, what about, you know, like I've historically made kind of a recommendation that if somebody is real sick, real inflamed, you know, for maybe a 2 to 3 week period, they might take a reasonably high amount of fish oils, obviously limiting linoleic acid, but then titrating down to a very low intake. Do you think that the potential for oxidative stress, do you think that that's a bad recommendation? Like, would you make that recommendation?
I don't know enough to answer that definitively. My, you know, crude thought experiment, back of the envelope reasoning would think that the rate at which you can replace the excess sixes with the threes in the cell membrane, I think you're going to hit, I don't think the rate determining step is how fast you're eating new threes. Mm-hmm. So my view is that you can't stuff them in there fast enough to avoid there being more oxidative damage than there is benefit. Now, could there be some other mechanism that I don't know about that maybe you can tell me what it is right now? Could there be some other mechanism like, you know, adding a couple of tablespoons of Carlson's fish oil a day can help you feel better quicker? Yeah, maybe there's some effect on the liver or the gut or some maybe some acute immune suppressing function apart from, you know, replacing the sixes with the threes slowly over time. I mean, are you aware of some mechanism like that, Rob? Is that what you're thinking? Or?
No, I'm not. And I mean, the more and more that I've gone down this path, like we actually have some examples of people with ulcerative colitis, some good literature showing that omega-3 supplementation of colitis in some people. And so this is where, like, historically I've just been thinking about, like, cooling the inflammatory flames, but, you know, not really thinking about it from the, you know, substrate replacement in that there's some choke valves on that, in that you're not going to get that conversion any faster by simply providing more substrate in there. That, you know, the liver is going to, at some point, just start perceiving these highly oxidizable omega-3s as being kind of a problem. And they start, you know, metabolizing that preferentially as a very oxidizable, high reactive oxygen species fuel source. And we don't really get folks further down the road and maybe actually enhancing the inflammatory response. So, you know, I've been back and forth on that, but the more and more I go down this road.
Yeah. So it sounds like you're sympathetic to that concern, just like I would be and Chris Presser would be.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know, this is something that Chris Kresser and I have talked about, and like he would definitely not recommend that approach. And so this may be where I need to revisit my fish oil calculator over on the Whole Nine site, and we need to pull the thing down. Like it may be a bad recommendation.
Yeah, I'm not even mentioning my skepticism of you know, trying to lower. You know, somebody having high triglycerides and trying to lower your triglyceride number by eating, you know, gobs of fish oil. I think that's probably when your triglycerides drop from that. It's probably because you're causing some toxic effect in your liver. I mean, literally, your liver's not able to get the triglycerides out. It's probably giving you a fatty liver instead of high triglycerides in your blood. So I'd be really suspicious of that therapy within your group. I guess the thing I would say, you know, to try and go your way a little bit is that if you were to say, well, if it makes you feel better and you're only doing it for a couple of weeks, I don't imagine anybody having a freaking heart attack, you know, taking a couple tablespoons of Carlson's for a few weeks. You know, I think that, my concern is more, you know, somebody doing it for months or years. But, yeah, I think that's an interesting example of you know, convergence, because I, you know, in my earlier posts, I said, oh, yeah, take fish oil if you can't eat fish, but I don't think of it that way now. I just think it's the fail-safe thing is just, you know, eat fish, or get a lot of terrestrial ruminant fat that's got the proper ratio, and don't eat stuff fried in insects.
It's also accounting for the all respect to the folks out there, but kind of the idiot factor, which is that there are a lot of people who will look at that high-end recommendation, they will read the fact that it's recommended for a brief period of time, and then they'll keep going right along doing it anyway. And so if there's question about whether or not it's a good idea to start off with, and then you obviously see consistently that people do not ratchet that intake down, then that you got to change that, or I've got to change that.
Yeah, and I think that's where we get ourselves in trouble. We get pigeonholed because we try to say things that are helpful, like, fruit, some fruit is just a bag of sugar on a tree, or it's candy bar from a tree. And you're trying to push the thinking one direction, and then somebody saying, this guy thinks apples are poison. I mean, for Christ's sake, what I'm trying to do when I say stuff like that is, I remember in the initial stages of saying, eat a diet that's kind of low-carb paleo thing. And everybody, I'm talking about actual patients I'm sitting in front of. What about apples and bananas and fruit and, watermelon? How much of that the first thing they want is permission to eat as much fruit as they can, because they can't, I told them that they can't drink pop and eat candy anymore. So that's where that comes from, is you're trying to say, no, I want you to think of that, for starters, as candy bar from a tree. Because that's how they're behaving. They're behaving as if, they're looking at the thing you're trying to get them to do, which is to, eat less. Basically, ultimately, what you're trying to do is get them to eat less food, okay? And that's the main thing. So the first thing, when you hear, the first thing they say is, how much of this can you keep eating too much food? So... But then you get pigeonholed by saying, oh, this guy thinks fruit is poison. I've actually eaten fruit my entire life. I've never completely stopped. I eat oranges. I eat stuff that, after a meal, it kind of cleans your palate. I eat an orange. It's got maybe 15 grams of total carbs in it, half of which is fructose. I've never, never thought that was bad. But you can only say so much on a blog post or in an interview, and... invariably, there's the idiot factor. People take whatever you say and they run with it. They're taking an entire bottle of Carlson's a day because of a little bit is good, a lot must be better. Or they're saying that you said that they're going to die if they eat, if they eat an apple. So, it just comes with the territory.
Totally. Which is also probably why we're somewhat burned out on arguing. But, yeah. Okay, Doc, possibly the most important question of the whole podcast, when the heck is your book coming out?
Well, after AHS, I got an email from Richard Nicolai, and I don't have it in front of me, but it was something like, Jesus Christ, I sure am glad I didn't write a stupid book. actually, it may have been in reference to Stefan's post, repudiating the carbohydrate hypothesis. Maybe it was in response to that. The thing is, actually been approached by three different publishers, one of which is Victory Belt, your publisher, unsolicited, have said, if you want to write a book, just let us know, we're good to go. The real reason I haven't written a book is to do a podcast a year after the book explaining why all the shit that I wrote in the book is wrong. Because no matter how smart you are, and no matter how honest you try to be and faithful, it will forever
be... You're going to get something wrong.
You have to get something wrong.
Right.
And that doesn't mean I'll never do it. I actually have some ideas floating around. And my main thing I would like to do, and I'm not trying to slam anybody specifically here, but I would like to write, I would like to write a book that uses actual, really up-to-date, genetics, paleoanthropology, and ethology, and tie it all together and make arguments, make inferences about, basically a book that says, how to eat based on the historical evidence. Not just speculation based on, you know, tested experiments, but, you know, kind of covering it all. And that would be a really hard book to write, because the thing is, I don't know it all yet. I'm trying to teach myself and learn. And, you know, I continually read books that are basically, you know, pop science, where you got a guy who's a journalist and he knows 10 times as much as I do, and it's just eye-opening and it leads to all other paths. So right now I'm reading a book called 1491, which is this fantastic book about how, you know, what the Americas were like before Columbus came, and, you know, it's fun for me to read that stuff and to be thinking in the background, I wonder about, you know, what dietary implications that would have, or what could that can tell us about health. So the kind of book I would envision writing, I just don't know enough to write it yet, because it's got to be something that interests me, but the stuff that interests me, I don't know well enough yet. But in the meantime, you know, if people can go onto the blog and, you know, look at the, you know, what started as the 12 steps, now I call it the Archipelago Diet, I'll probably rewrite that soon. You know, probably what I should do is put a branch point in there where I say, okay, that, you know, like you follow a flow chart, and I could probably put some branch point that says, you know, do you have a goatee and live in a really liberal city? Okay, eat more plants. You know, do you live in the prairie and like to hunt? Okay, get more of your calories from shit that you killed yourself. Because honestly, I think some of those differences, you know, like when Stefan, I don't think there's anything wrong with this. I think it's inevitable. I think when a guy like Stefan says, well, you know, I think the optimal diet is not only, it could be either more carbs or more animal fats. I think it's more towards the more carbs thing. It's probably kind of influenced by other aspects of the culture that we live in and identify with. And I lived a lot of my life. I lived at one point in a town called Storm Lake, Iowa, which is not far from Sioux City, Iowa. I mean, the Lakota, you know, the Lakota Sioux used to live in an area where I lived, and it's kind of part of a culture. You know, so part of the way I think of things is in terms of what the people in the upper prairie used to eat. But I think that the point is, it's equally legitimate to say I have a diet, you know, based on, you know, eating animals, and I have a diet based on digging tubers out of the ground. I think it's a horse apiece for most people. I don't think you have to say, you know, what did my ancestors eat? I think most people could adapt to either kind of diet. And a lot of those choices are actually going to be personal. What do you prefer to eat? So people like can just choose what
they want. I like it. And, you know, it's kind of a, honestly, even though, like, I've been, like, the high carb, or the, you know, the low carb dude and the paleo dude and all the rest of that, I, you know, 10, almost 15 years down the road here, having done all this stuff, it's actually a kind of a liberating kind of scene to see this opening back up and just kind of understanding what is it probably that's making people sick, you know, some lifestyle factors, some grain, some fructose, some linoleic acid, you know, vitamin D deficiency. Like, there's some stuff that we can really hang our hat on. And then from there, it starts opening back up. The aperture opens up. And what we could probably eat and get away with and live a, you know, we've got 100-year-old Katavans, we've got 100-year-old Okinawans, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of latitude in there that we could get away with and be fit and strong and healthy. And it doesn't just have to be a ketogenic diet. It doesn't just have to be a low-carb diet. You know, it doesn't have to fall under one parameter.
Yeah, and to give another nod to Stefan again, you know, with his food reward thing, when I do start blogging again, which I will when some other things are taken care of, I'm going to do some blogging about this food reward idea, because it solves a lot. It fills in a lot of the missing holes in a lot of this, where you go, I can't understand this. I put this person on a whole foods diet. They're eating all paleo approved this. They're not eating this. They're eating that. They're still fat, or maybe they're even gaining weight. The food reward concept, by bringing in not just food quality and the micro and macronutrients and, you know, is it a real whole food, but how food is cooked, how it's prepared and combined with other foods can affect how much of it we eat. You know, bringing those concepts in opens that aperture even further, at least in the therapeutic sense, because I still think that when you do this stuff, if you stay fat or you're gaining weight or you're not down to what you know, and you know all you got to do is look in the mirror. You don't need a scale. You know if you're fat or not. If you're doing something and you're still fat or you're gaining weight, you know, something needs to be tweaked. And right. You can say, oh, I'm doing everything right. All my health markers look good. I really do more and more think the best health marker is to look at what your body's doing with that energy. If for some reason, you know, your hypothalamus is telling you to keep eating until you pack on the fat, whether it's an ancestral tweak or not, you need to do something. Even if food award turns out to only be a therapeutic maneuver, you need to do it without caring or wondering whether it's part of the ancestral milieu to have bland tasting food or whatever. I think that's a separate issue. But I think that's something very important that Stefan has brought up, and you know, I'm paying a lot of attention to it at least.
Yeah, and you know, within that, like for me, my head's very much in this endotoxemia, kind of low-grade sepsis and all the rest of that, and you know, all of that being kind of an outgrowth of whether it's FODMAPs or different gut irritants. But to me, the food reward thing kind of slides right under that, in that we know that there are opiate-type, you know, chemicals in a variety of these foods that we're talking about. And my gut sense is that it's going to end up sliding kind of under that house, but I really like where Stefan's going with all this stuff. And that's just kind of my own pet theory in this thing, and that's where I've been trying to see if there's some integration between dysregulation of appetite related to either acute or chronic sepsis and some adaptive mechanisms with chronic infections with things like syphilis, treponema pallidum, you know, some of these things that avoid the immune system. What are the long-term effects on appetite and immune response and stuff like that? Just seeing if there's any interesting stuff in there. And I've been working... That may be part of the next book, maybe part of a bunch of blog posts, but I think there's definitely some interesting stuff there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting thinking about the infection angle too and what that might mean.
Well, Doc, that's an hour and 45 minutes. This is the longest podcast we have ever done.
Except for the 12-minute long one we had last week.
Yeah, yeah. Which I'm surprised people didn't complain that much about it. Maybe they're getting tired of us too, so... Doc,
well, you could always just take and split this into two, I suppose, too. You know, if you want to,
this will be the hypercaloric overfeeding for people. So this will be the really big meal,
the refeed.
Yeah, the refeed. Well, Doc, thanks so much for coming on. Huge honor having you on here, and hopefully we'll drag you back on in maybe like 4 to 6 months, and because I know this is going to spawn a bunch more questions.
Hey, anytime, Rob. It's been a real pleasure, and you know, sorry for the logorrhea, but maybe it compensates for the lack of blog posts in 6 months. I hope it's been helpful.
It's super helpful for me. You answered a bunch of my questions, and I'm actually going to be pulling down the fish oil calculator after we get off the recording here. So, yeah, it helped me for sure.
Great, Rob. Awesome. Have a good day now.
Yeah, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.